And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM. It is my distinct privilege to be able to introduce America's foremost consumer and citizen rights advocate, Ralph Nader. We have him on the line to discuss his new book, which you're going to be hearing a lot about. Now, of course, for the last 45 years, Ralph Nader has challenged corporations, government agencies, and institutions to be more accountable to the public. Back in 1965, Unsafe at Any Speed changed the face of the automobile industry and made Ralph Nader a household name. As a result of his efforts, cars have more safety features. His lobbying and writing on the food industry ensured that the food we buy is required to pass strict guidelines before reaching the consumer. And one of his greatest achievements was the 1974 amendment to the Freedom of Information Act that gave increased public access to government documents, brought a level of press freedom, resulting in increased access for journalists. So, Ralph, again, thank you so much for being on our program today.
Good afternoon, Brendan. Nice to be with you.
Well, hopefully sound levels are coming in great. I just wanted to let our audience and listeners know, first of all, that Ralph Nader is coming to Hamilton next week. That's Wednesday, July 31st. He's going to be at the Hamilton Central Library, 55 York Boulevard. That's the fourth floor of the central branch of the Hamilton Public Library. He's going to be launching his new book, Told You So, the big book of weekly columns. I hear it's already sold out, but you can call Brian Prince Bookseller at 905-528-4508. We'll give more information about that throughout the program and afterwards. But Ralph, wow, your book is called Told You So, a very appropriate title. I was looking through a lot of the book over the last few days, and one of the best examples of you telling America so is an article you wrote right at the end of 2006. It wasn't long before the financial collapse, and the article was called Taking the Cop Off the Corporate Crime Beat. Maybe you remember that one. You warned about the danger of ongoing deregulation throughout what you called a seven-year corporate financial crime wave, and that was just at the end of 2006. That was one such article in a long line of warnings like that. So that 2007 crisis wasn't some kind of freak accident, because, I mean, you pretty much spent the better part of a decade outlining the whole regulatory collapse that allowed that to happen, didn't you?
Yes, I mean, one of the reasons I called the book Told You So, which is not reflective of my practice, is that I got very concerned about many leading public figures in the United States telling people what wasn't so, developing a narrative of fiction garnished by deception and self-seeking profit interests. And we saw that with the push toward NAFTA and WTO. We saw it with the push to reinstate nuclear power. We saw it with the invasion, the criminal invasion of Iraq. We saw these neocons and neoliberals pushing for small enforcement budgets on corporate crime. We saw it again and again, and they were wrong, and the country was harmed, and people lost their lives, or they lost their livelihoods. And what happens to these public figures, these neocons and neoliberals? They get promoted, they get big-paying jobs, they get huge book advances, they get $100,000, $200,000 speeches, and they get called by the national press to be on the Sunday talk shows and on other widely circulated media. Now, on the other side, what we call the progressive leaders, these people have been right again and again and again. They have warned, they have cautioned, they have predicted. And what's the response by the power structure? To marginalize them, keep them off the op-ed pages of the New York Times or the network television, block them from testifying before Congress. And so this reflects a serious decay in the political economy and the concentration of power by the few over the many. That's what happens. And so I thought that this book, which collects short columns on almost every conceivable issue affecting people every day, that this book would, taken together, portray a reality that we have to connect with if we're going to turn our countries around and stop the decline economically, politically, ethically, in terms of the future of our descendants. And so, taken together, these articles paint a reality that replaces the myths, the lies, and the distortions,
you know,
that reflected our invasion of Iraq.
Your book covers a wide range of topics, but as you're indicating, there's a common thread that runs through all of those topics, and that seems to be this unchecked agglomeration, this growth, snowballing of corporate power, such to the extent that it marginalizes all other voices in the Congress, in the Senate, in the legal structure, and all over the place. And although you've been writing about similar issues, I noticed that the book itself covers material predominantly from about 2004 to 2011 or 2012. So why did you choose that 8-year period in general?
Yes, well, because it was there's a coherence to it. It represented both Democrat and Republicans pushing one way or another for deregulation. Remember, the deregulation of Wall Street and the banks was the product of the Clinton administration and the Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin. So it wasn't just the Republicans. It was sort of the collapse of any political competition between the two parties. And I thought that span of years was very good. And let's face it, historically, the struggle for justice in most societies is a struggle between civic values of peace, justice, tolerance, foresight, adequate reward for hard work, compared to the corporatist dominant approach, which is to squeeze every possible dollar out of working people and the taxpayers and put it in the coffers of the 1% or the very few. And that's what this book really chronicles, is that struggle. And it also illustrates some very heroic people who have defeated powerful corporate interests for a time, and people who are role models for a lot of people who just sit at home, twiddle their thumbs, complain about the country and where it's going, but don't fulfill their potential to lock arms with other people and build a stronger democracy, which is what most people really want. They want a stronger democracy because they know that a stronger democracy involves a fairer distribution of power, wealth, income, and opportunity.
That's right. You're what the Romans would have called a people's tribune. I know Michael Parenti was asking, where are our tribunes? And Ralph Nader has been one. And, of course, Ralph's book, Told You So, the big book of weekly columns, covers these wide range of topics, but it does hint at a number of interesting issues. Now, I am so glad that you were able to reference the work of other people, consumer advocates, lawyers. You referenced Alexander Coburn and Chris Hedges on Obama's constitutional issues and how the debates should be framed. I guess, you know, Washington is a big focus here, and you've been marginalized, or there's been attempts to marginalize you in the journalistic apparatus of the United States and also in the political apparatus, of course. And I'm struck by a statement that Cindy Sheehan and others made, which is that there seems to be, you know, in Congress, at least on some issues, just one party, a war party. So when it comes to the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex, you're dealing with two wings of the same party. Would you agree with that statement in terms of war and other issues?
Oh, yes. And, you know, President Eisenhower, in his final address to the American people in 1961, where he coined the phrase military-industrial complex, he was going to say military-industrial-congressional complex, but he didn't want to alienate the politicians. But basically, the inference was that it was supported and funded and not overseen by both parties, even way back then. And it's just gotten tremendously worse. Half of our discretionary budget in this country, if you set aside health insurance budget, like Medicare and Medicaid, half of the budget is military, and we don't have any major enemy left in the world. So we have to exaggerate a bunch of criminal gangs, go into countries, blow them apart, Afghanistan, Iraq, and now drones in a dozen countries, violating international law, national sovereignties, our own constitutional restraints and statutes, in order to justify this huge military budget, which is as large as all the other countries' military budgets combined, including our allies Great Britain and France and Japan, as well as China and Russia. So we've got to turn it around, because one effect of disclosing too many bad situations that people are not aware of, although they could be now with the Internet, just fingertip access, is that people get discouraged and they get gloomy. They get, you know, into a bad state of mind where they give up. And they say, oh, what's the use anyway? I'll just try to get through the day with my friends and relatives and enjoy myself when I'm not working hard and take life as it is. Well, that is not respecting our future generations, is it? I mean, people in Canada, they reflected what was known as the Canadian consensus that was elaborated by Ed Broadbent of the NDP. And I thought he summarized the Canadian consensus, which is the product heavily of Canadians' forebears going back over 100 years. And now the social safety net in Canada, as pointed out by the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives in Ottawa, is fraying. In our country, the social safety net is disintegrating. But in Canada, it's fraying. And that safety net was summarized by Mr. Broadbent. He called it the Canadian consensus. Basically, they were rights of citizenship. That is, if you lived in Canada, you had certain rights, and they were pensions and universal health care, trade union rights for collective bargaining, comprehensive unemployment insurance, and the expectation that every, as he put it, Mr. Broadbent, every Canadian boy and girl with ability could go to university, and all were paid for by adequate levels of progressive taxation, end quote. That's his words. So instead, we have the Washington consensus that is dominating the U.S. and Canada. That means you have globalization, corporate globalization. You don't protect domestic workers. You don't protect workers in third world countries. You exploit them with modern capital equipment and send the products back to Western countries. You don't supply adequate retirement security. You don't pay a living wage. You don't crack down on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse, which is at crime levels unforeseen in American history. Just read the Wall Street Journal.
Yes.
Just read that. And you don't do the things that a majority of people think amount to fair play, you know, just the right thing to do, you know, you boil it down. And so the Washington consensus has been creeping northward to Canada. As we all know, the Harper government is very reflective of a lot of what Reagan tried to do. And that's really the debate on both sides of the border. Is it going to be a civic culture of justice and fairness, responsiveness, openness? Or is it going to be a militarized, corporatized, commercialized culture and society where we don't even, beyond lip service, take care of the children? And in the U.S., child poverty is up. It's up in Canada, too. Not as bad as the U.S., but it's up in Canada, too. So Canadian independence is extremely important. You want to preserve what you have and not be pulled down by the giant from the south. You don't want to have your economy totally controlled by absentee U.S. and British and other corporations, because then your politics will be controlled. And finally, and what's really important for Canadians to understand is that the military net, the North America Security Agreement concept, is designed to break, and it is breaking, Canada's worldwide reputation as peacekeepers and mediators, a la Lester Pearson, your former premier, into a military adjunct of the U.S. empire. And you can see that with Canadians losing their lives in Afghanistan and allying, fortunately, Prime Minister Chrétien kept Canada out of the Iraq disaster. But there are very, very few Canadians at the U.N. now working peacekeeping issues. And that reflects a growing militarization by the U.S. Washington consensus in Canada. And Canadians have to resist it. And it doesn't take that much because you got huge public opinion behind Canadian independence. In fact, a poll about a year and a half ago of young Canadians showed that they think Canada is becoming more like the U.S. and they didn't seem to like it.
Well, you're indicating that it is possible to make things better, and we had a nicer arrangement in Canada decades ago. It is being torn apart, as it's already been torn apart in the United States. So I think we largely took the welfare state and we took mass democracy for granted. People were able to make improvements like the Occupational Health and Safety Act. They were able to make safety improvements, as you did, during that post-war period. Today, the introduction of your book, Told You So, is by Jim Hightower, and he suggests that Nixon, the things he did would be considered too liberal today to fit the Democrats.
That's right.
But the thing is, he did those things, according to Hightower, because he was pressured by movements. And, you know, you can see these negative changes over the last few decades in the United States and now in Canada as well, and people do see it here. I guess one of the problems that we're facing is, it was revealed in the discussion about Edward Snowden, for example. And basically, the media was focusing on one particular set of questions, and that was, why doesn't Snowden come back to face trial? And I was reading Daniel Ellsberg's article in the Washington Post, and he said Snowden was right to leave because the America of the 1970s is not the America of today. So have we really gone down that far?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's far more government secrecy. It's become now a practice of imprisoning people without charges. That was done right after 9/11 and continuing. Torture still going on, domestic and foreign. Look what they did to Bradley Manning. They basically tortured him in prison, solitary confinement, stripping him naked, psychological torture. And he hadn't even been charged with anything. I mean, that's a serious violation of Anglo-American jurisprudence and due process. Then you have criminal wars without constitutional authority via the Congress. That's been violated. You have invasions all the time going on, drone attacks. None of them, they're acts of war, in effect, but none of them authorized by Congress in terms of declaring war. No, I mean, it's in one area after another, the system of tort law is being weakened. Contracts, we don't have contractual freedom anymore for most of our current consumer purchases. All a fine print contract, one-sided, keep you out of the courts. The vendors triumphant. They set the terms, and then they have the nerve to say that we have the right to unilaterally violate this credit card contract or this insurance contract or this mortgage. That leaves nothing left of contract. So this is all very serious, but we shouldn't get discouraged because the majority of the people know the elementary principles of justice and fair play. We have far more solutions in Canada and the U.S. than we apply, and far more problems that we don't deserve. And so we got to connect a vibrant democratic movement to bring these solutions that are on the shelf or just in pilot projects here and there and bring them to traditional practice, whether it's in our cities, our suburbs, rural areas, you name it. We have far more solutions dealing with our energy, dealing with housing, dealing with retirement security. But they're not going to be applied if we give up our power to the top 1%. And I say in the U.S. to voters, why are you giving so much of your power to 535 senators and representatives in Congress? And they'd sell this power to commercial campaign donors, and then they turn the U.S. government against its own people.
Yes.
This is absurd. And so we don't want to have citizens give excuses for themselves, because once they make excuses for themselves, they give up. And so we want to basically say, there's no excuse. You just need about 1% of the people in Canada or the United States to become connected, vibrant civic advocates, coast to coast, in every riding and in every congressional district, representing forward redirections and agendas that are supported, perhaps silently, by the majority of the Canadian and American people, and you're going to win.
Well, sometimes you just need a wake-up call, and you did try to warn about the two-tier justice system that was being created. You know, one set of rules for corporations, one set of rules for everyone else, and, you know, they get all the handouts, they get all the freebies, they get all the get-out-of-jail-free cards, literally, everyone else gets stomped on. We in Canada, suffering these same problems. I know we had this rail disaster in Quebec, and it turns out over the last few decades that they've reduced the number of conductors on these trains from 5 to 3 and 2. And now they have one person pulling a train full of oil, that has been shipped through the U.S. and then Canada and the U.S. It's in a big circle. I guess this is something that could have been foreseen. And now people are having this discussion about whether we should be using pipelines to move the oil or whether we should be using rail. What's your take on that situation?
First of all, we've got far more available different forms of solar and energy conservation. We waste more energy in North America than any other country or region in the world. And so we waste way over half our energy by the criteria of available energy efficiency technology. I mean, just look at our motor vehicles, for example. Now, we've had progress in energy efficiency over the last 30 years, and that progress just foresees even greater progress in efficiency. Energy efficiency technology is way ahead of its application, whether it's in terms of industrial processes, lighting, heating, air conditioning, the loss of energy in power plants. We know how to do this, but, you know, energy waste spells more sales for ExxonMobil, for Peabody Coal, for the nuclear power. So there's this perverse incentive by the energy vendors who, the more energy's wasted, the more money they make, unless the regulators turn them around and change the incentives, which in some areas in our country is happening. They reward electric utilities with megawatts instead of megawatts. Megawatts meaning they reward them in proportion to how much energy they save. So it all comes down to, are we going to be ruled by a few and run into the ground as a nation, handing this over to our children and grandchildren? Or are we going to turn it around? And if people listening have you know, the ability to say to themselves, well, I'm active, I vote, I know who I vote for, I mobilize, I petition, I rally. Well, the question is, do you persuade others, or do you just stay in your own circle of activism and sort of carp about the apathy of the masses? Remember, people are apathetic when they feel powerless. Once they start feeling power, they cease their apathy, because apathy spells a lot of pain and a lot of frustration and a lot of grief and a lot of grievance, and people don't like that. But they swallow it if they feel powerless. It's up to the active citizens to multiply enormously their numbers and reflect the history of U.S. and Canada, which is, it's always been just a few active people who've turned our countries around and given us, down through the years, what we think are the blessings of America and the blessings of Canada, which are now under severe attrition.
Yes, and you would know, and that's a very powerful statement about resistance. It's just about time to go, but obviously the work you did in these columns in Told You So, the big book of weekly columns, you can clearly see that it would have helped set a sort of theoretical basis for a lot of what the Occupy movement did. And you certainly commented on that in your book. So people might be able to ask you questions about this on the 31st when you're talking at the Hamilton Public Library Central Branch. But as we go out, you know, how do you feel that the Occupy movement unfolded? What's your take on that, and what kind of actions do you expect or hope to see in the immediate future?
Well, it was a good first step. It was in over 120 communities, these encampments of Occupy Wall Street. But they didn't like any organization. They didn't like leaders, and they didn't even like leadership. And so they were very vulnerable when the police came and threw them out of the encampments. They didn't have anything there. And I tried to urge them to rally around the minimum wage. The minimum wage in the U.S. is 7.25 federal, like in New York State now. In Ontario, it's $10.25. Now, there are 30 million American workers today who are making less in inflation-adjusted wages than workers made in 1968, inflation-adjusted. Just imagine going backwards into the future. 30 million workers, plus their children, are expected to live on less than workers made in 1968 in terms of real purchasing power. So I think that the Occupy Wall Street, they had a good, you know, approach. They got a lot of media. They raised the inequity issues. But then they petered out, because maybe you may not like leaders. Maybe you may not like rulers of citizen movements, but you cannot deny leadership in one segment of your movement after another. If you do, you're not going to organize anything. And now, people still read about the right-wing Tea Party, but they hear very little about the Occupy Party. So that's a lesson learned, and we've got to turn it around.
Yeah, and you've set out the key issues in your book, and you'll be presenting on that next week. So maybe people that want to get into these movements, they can read about all of these issues. Set up, now they have a basis for debate to talk about these ideas and what they want to do. So I'm glad you're bringing this to Hamilton. I know the venue's probably already sold out by now. I'll announce some details about it later, but I just wanted to thank you once again so very much for being with us on our program today.
Well, thank you, Brendan. My website is nader.org. If you want to get my weekly column free electronically, nader.org. And if we're oversubscribed at the library, we can do two back-to-back.
Wow, well, that's very generous of you. Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you, Brendan. Thank your audience.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And, of course, that was America's foremost consumer and citizen rights advocate, Ralph Nader. He will be coming to Hamilton on Wednesday, July 31st, 2013. So that's just next week at 7 o'clock p.m. down to 8 o'clock. And I guess maybe it'll be 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock if he can do a back-to-back program. The poster already says it was sold out. I'm told that they had scheduled to hold it at Brian Prince Bookseller, the very nice bookstore right near McMaster, but it immediately filled up instantly. And so they moved it to the Hamilton Central Library branch. And you've probably seen some of the lecture rooms they have there. That's already that filled up too. That's sold out. well, maybe you can call in some favors. You can call Brian Prince at 905-528-4508. See if you can get in there. You can at least get a copy of the book. Maybe you can get an autographed copy somehow. It's worth checking out. The event is sponsored by Hamilton Public Library. They're sponsoring the venue, and he was brought by Brian Prince Bookseller. The book is done through Random House and Seven Stories Press, and this is also being organized through Oberg McMaster. Just as Doug said, Ralph was instrumental in setting up the public interest research groups. And I got to say, in his book, Told You So, the big book of weekly columns, he has an article from about 2005, 2006 saying, you know, why aren't we talking about Enron? People are talking like Enron was 1,000 years ago, but it was just 5 or 6 years ago. And this is an ongoing problem that shows major flaws in the system. And he was right. And they didn't listen. And then we had a much larger financial collapse based on the same weaknesses and flaws that he indicated. And now in his book, reading through it, he indicates how there hasn't been much regulatory change or anything like that. Even in the Great Depression, changes were made by FDR just 2 years afterwards, but not now, not here. So there's a lot of work that has to be done. Ralph has a lot of ideas about what to do. It's not like we're working in a vacuum. So you can pick up his book. I recommend going to the event if you can. And if not, I'm pretty sure, you know, they'll open it up for you in some way. You can find it online as an ebook, and it comes in a paperback. But of course, we'd love to get it here from Ralph.